back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site, HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Before we jump into today's interview, here's a reminder, you can subscribe to @Lungcast on YouTube to get new and archived episodes, as well as interview segments and episode highlights throughout the month. And if you prefer a podcast, you can subscribe to Lungcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your favorite listening platforms. You can also register for more respiratory news and insights at both lung.org and hcplive.com. Today's guest is Dr. Parth Rally, Associate Professor of Thoracic Medicine and Surgery at Temple University's Lewis Katz School of Medicine. An expert in pulmonary embolism, he joins us for a review of every stage in the pulmonary embolism care process, from screening and imaging to optimal intervention and long-term outpatient management. It's going to be a comprehensive conversation on a concerning condition. So let me set the stage. PE, or pulmonary embolism, is generally described as an obstruction in the pulmonary artery due to a blood clot, tumor, air, or fat. Today, we're focusing on blood clots. Pulmonary embolism is right now the third most common cause of death among hospitalized patients. Older age, comorbid cardiopulmonary diseases, and the thrombolytic treatment used in this population are associated with increased healthcare costs and at times worse outcomes. Even with therapy, patients with pulmonary embolism can have mild to moderate functional impairment even after 18 months from the initial event. Dr. Parth Rally, whose expertise lies in pulmonary vascular disease, particularly pulmonary embolism, is a co-author of the article Submassive Pulmonary Embolism, published in the American Journal of Respiratory and Critical Care Medicine in September of 2018, as well as one of the authors of The Diagnosis, Treatment, and Follow-up of Acute Pulmonary Embolism, a consensus practice from the PERT Consortium, published in the Clinical and Applied Thrombosis Hemostasis Volume 25 in 2019. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Rally. Before we begin speaking of submassive pulmonary embolism, I did want to ask you to define some terms. We hear such things as acute, chronic, subacute, saddle, segmental, massive, and submassive embolism, which was the topic of one of your articles. More recently, I've noticed that the classification now is concerning low risk, intermediate low, intermediate high, and high risk. Can you tell us about these different nomenclatures and what are the important aspects of these that we should understand?
Thank you, Dr. Rizzo, and thank you for having me there. And this is a perfect question to start because I think that's where a lot of confusion starts, because you will hear people mixing this terminology. Even with intermediate, they'll say submassive intermediate or submassive high risk and high risk. So let's take a step back. Let me start with what should be the anatomical definitions or where the blood clot lies. So the commonly described word that we all get freaked out when we hear the word saddle pulmonary embolism, that's an absolute radiological terminology. So it does not mean any clinical, direct clinical bearings to how that patient may look like. So saddle pulmonary embolism is a clot that is right in the main pulmonary artery and going into right and the left at the bifurcation. It's a purely radiological term. The literature, when you have a central clot, the literature do suggest that those patients may be at a higher risk of decompensation, but not necessarily. Sometimes that saddle embolism could be a small, thin mustache that we like to describe, or it could be a very obstructive, thick mustache. And the complication of that are very diverse. So the word saddle embolism is purely a radiological term, should be used by a radiologist sitting and reading that CAT scan. Along with those same terminologies, the word lobar, sublobar, segmental, and subsegmental also should be a radiological terms. It almost tells you where the clot location is in relation to lung parenchyma. We know there is an anatomical lobar lobe, and then there's subsegments, and along with that. So those are radiological terms. They should not mean how those patients behave clinically. I'll give you a simple example. There was a patient that we saw last week who was walking a dog and passed out. He likely had a saddle embolism, but then he recovered. When he got a CAT scan, his skull clot was shattered all over. It was described as multiple segmental and subsegmental embolism. Clinically, that patient behaved much differently. So if you don't correlate your clinical findings and the features along with what we saw in radiology, you're bound to make mistakes because somebody could have just read that CAT scan and undermined his disease severity. So I think now we have clarified what radiological terms are. let's go back into the classification. So there are three good classification guidelines. One is from American Heart Association. One is American College of Chest Physicians, which is chest guidelines, which we all kind of dearly follow in terms of management. And third is more recent is European Society of Cardiology guidelines. So AHA and ACCP guidelines have been using the terms low risk, submassive, or massive PE that we all are familiar with, right? I think what has changed and what has kind of we all have adapted clinically is more of an ESC classification, which kind of parallels the ACCP and AHA classification in terms of low risk, meaning the patients have no biomarkers. They have clinical parameters of clinical scores like PASI and SPASI are negative, and there's no evidence of RV dysfunction. So the low-risk PE is a low-risk PE across all the definitions. Massive PE or a high-risk PE, so the ESC classification uses the word high-risk PE, interchangeable term for massive PE. They are also pretty much the same in terms of, but each guideline would give a different definition of high-risk or massive PE. An example to us is like we all know that drop in blood pressure more than 90, for 15 minutes is massive across the spectrum. ESC will also tell you drop in systolic blood pressure 40 from your baseline, which I think sometimes we miss it because we see our blood pressure is 120. But no, but because of the EMR, that blood pressure, baseline blood pressure for that patient in the past could have been 160. So 120 for them is a massive or high-risk PE. AHA also kind of defines syncope as a presentation of PE as a massive category. Severe bradycardia is also a presentation of massive or a high-risk PE. So that's clarified that way. Now we get into this, the most common, but the most unknown, the gray zone PE that we only used to call a submassive PE. What ESC classification allows us to do that further restrict the patient. They don't call submassive, they call it intermediate risk PE, as you mentioned. But it also allows them to subclassify that intermediate risk PE into two spectrum of intermediate low risk and intermediate high risk. So now instead of three categorization, you have four subcategorization which are solely based on your clinical presentation. So you have low risk, then you have intermediate low risk, then you have intermediate high risk, and then you have a high risk. What it allows us to do is that it allows that this big bucket of intermediate risk PE to split into the two subcategories. And what we like to believe that people who are at the intermediate high risk category may further deteriorate and may become a high risk spectrum. People who are in intermediate low risk category may tend to behave, and if you watch them carefully, they may kind of behave more like a low-risk PE. And that is based on the evidence, this classification. So that's why we clinically would like to use the word instead of submassive, we like to use intermediate. And then we need to take a step forward and reclassify them into intermediate low-risk and intermediate high-risk based on the clinical parameters.
Well, that certainly clears up the terminology very nicely. Thank you for that. Now, the diagnosis and ultimately the treatment for pulmonary embolism is aided by several tools, some of which you've already mentioned, but it also includes certain prediction scores, such as the Pulmonary Embolism Severity Index. Can you speak a little bit to this tool and discuss how that tool and some other important lab values can help with the diagnosis and in the short-term mortality prediction?
Absolutely. And I think I'll take a one step back that even though I just said that this classification of ESC classification is great, and we have four categories of that, I think I want audience to be reminded of that this is a moving classification. It's a snapshot classification. So I think you should not bucket your patient into one classification and not to revisit them, because a lot of this classification, what it tells you that you need to watch them closely or watch them in ICU or change in vitals, because these patients, it's like a pendulum which kind of swings back and forth. And I really hope that every patient that I see, the pendulum swings from the high category, high risk features to a lower category. But there is a 10, 15, 20% of patients that we know in this intermediate risk category move towards the high risk spectrum. And I think we should kind of keep a vigilant eye on that to follow that. So it's not like a traffic light signal that I always tell them, red, green, and yellow, even though that's the color that we have used in the classification. It's a little bit more like a moving traffic that goes in the both. Going back to how do we should classify this patient or what are the things that we should pay attention? Obviously, I'll go one by one. I think the most common being the CTPA, right? The CTPA is 99% of the way how we diagnose the pulmonary embolism. But what we also can do is that CT pulmonary angiogram is such a useful tool to prognosticate, to identify the RV dysfunction on that. And the reason why I say it's very important, because echo, sometimes you want to get echo done on every patient, but it's not available. Or if you don't have, you may not have access to the focus. people may not be expert in interpreting RV dysfunction, which is slightly different than the LVH. I think we all are much better as a focus and point of care ultrasound enthusiastic to pick up the LV dysfunction, not necessarily the RV dysfunction. But CTPL allows us to measure the RV size, the ratios, contrast of reflux into IVC, septum position of the right ventricle and left ventricle. So you can use easily these three parameters to classify where this patient is. Example, if I have that saddle PE patient, and if I just look at their CAT scan, and if I know that their RV to LV ratio, meaning that RV looks the same size as LV, you don't even need to measure it, right? We all know that RV, LV should be 2/3, 1/3, meaning that RV should be 1/3, LV should be 2/3. If you look at while you are scrolling down your images, and if you look at them, both the chambers look the same size, you're automatically, without any EKG marker, without any biochemical markers, based on the ESC classification, we already know that you're dealing with intermediate risk PE, right? So I think you're already risk stratifying your patient, and you're one step ahead in the game in terms of classifying that patient. So I always use that as my immediate tool, because that's how we make the diagnosis. So CTPA to me acts as a diagnostic and also prognostic tool, because it's one imaging gives me two answers. Moving forward, did I tell that we don't need an echocardiogram? Absolutely not, right? Echo has its own value, because if you decide to observe that patient and that patient is improving or deteriorating, echo will tell you a dynamic information. We are not giving contrast. It can be reproducible. It can be repeated, right? And you may decide to give some volume to your patient and see what happens. So I think echo is extremely important too. Some other things that I always want to get an echo, if I'm worried about clot in transit or if I'm worried about a free floating clot, I would always prefer to get an echocardiogram to make sure. Or sometimes I'm worried about PFO, where I'm worried about clot from right to the left. I think those are the three scenarios I would absolutely get an echo before I make my decision. But even in the classification, RV dysfunction, picking it up to classify the patient, we can use either echo or CTPA. So both of have them additive value, but just for the audience, I think for the classification purposes, you need to do either of them right away to classify your patient. Because there are studies that are published that sometimes it can take up to 13 hours, even at an academic centers, to get the echo done and then read, and then you're delaying the care of those patients. Some of the additional tools that I use is lactic acid. I think that has come to a surface. It is not part of the guidelines. It's certainly part of the discussion. You see a lactic acid in the range of 2, 3, and 4. You don't see a lactic acid of 6, 8, 9 that we see in the sepsis patient. What it tells you that you're trying to pick up the end organ hypoperfusion. So just positive lactic acid in the setting of PE where there's no other confounding factors for PE is extremely important, because lactic acid more than 4 is associated with close to 40% PE associated mortality. So I think that's some of the markers that we have been using clinically very much likely. Obviously, you have your troponins. BNP and proBNP used to be part of classification. I think because of the lot of false positivity, it has moved out of the favor a bit. But again, certainly easy tool to use that. Along with that, other markers of hyperperfusion, which could be AKI, acute kidney injury, mild abnormalities of LFTs, hyponatremia. And we don't need to see the extremes of these values, because as an intensivist and as a lung pulmonologist, when we say AKI, we need to have a gradient of 6 and patient has to be aneuric. We are talking about simple AKI, very early onset liver injuries. Those all tells you that RV is in a dysfunctional state and you have a reverse flow pattern and you have hepatic congestion. So those are all markers of hyperperfusion that we should use. And answering your final question about the clinical scores, and I think this is where the evidence has moved the field forward, that now we have PESI score, which is PE severity index score, which is part of classification. It values 10 parameters and allows and predicts a 30-day short-term mortality. And a short version of it, which call it a simplified PESI score, which has 6 parameters like abnormal heart rate, abnormal cardiopulmonary diseases, abnormal respiratory rate, simple vitals that you can use. And if it is positive, it tells you, again, a 30-day mortality marker helps you classify those patients in intermediate risk category or not. Those have made it to the classification. But there are also other scores like a BOVA score, which is also well-validated. So some institutions may prefer to use instead of SPECI versus BOVA. It has almost similar parameters, but slightly differently validated. I use it clinically all the time. And one more thing I would still in terms of decision, because right when you risk stratify the patient, next thing that you're talking about is treatment, right? So I think some of the bleeding risk scores, I think every patient, we are in the era where the options are unlimited, luckily, for the treatment of PE treatments. But I think we still need to identify which patient fits into which bucket. So I also, same article that you referred before, I also talk about a bleeding risk scores, because we need to rather than saying, oh, I think it's a bleeding, high bleeding risk versus I think it's fine. And then we go into this lot of subjective arguments. We have a decent amount of bleeding risk score, which predicts the bleeding on anticoagulation only, right? So now you're talking about giving somebody a TPA. So obviously you take that and you can understand how high or low bleeding risk may be. So I think once I stratify those patients with this clinical parameters biomarkers, I move to a next step about using some form of bleeding risk score, which is more standardized. So when you're talking to your colleagues, you're talking in a similar evidence-based terminology rather than one opinion versus another.
I didn't hear you mention D-dimer at all. Is that still something that plays a role?
Yeah, so D-dimer should play a role, I think, in terms of diagnosis. I think if we talk about like who should be screened for D-dimer, I think just trying to revalue the opinion of D-dimer has a value on patients who are coming to the ER, not necessarily who patients who have been admitted for 2, 3, 4 days. It loses its value, like COPD, CHF, because that once you're hospitalized, a lot of other factors will give you false positive D-dimer. So I think it has a role upfront in the diagnosis of D-dimer. One other value that it has also surfaced recently in the evidence is the role in the post-PE management. So sometimes you have an isolated subsegmental PE, one clot, tiny beta clot, and question arises, should we anticoagulate that patient or not? And the guidelines have suggested that if there are no clots in the leg, and if you do a serial D-dimer and the trend is downtrending, you can either take them off the anticoagulation, or you, if you have not started the anticoagulation and the trend is in a forward direction, meaning that D-dimer was X and now D-dimer has gone to a lower number, you are in a safe zone, not anticoagulating patient, particularly somebody that has a high bleeding risk. So I think those are the two scenarios that I use the D-dimer, first diagnosing, second kind of in terms of determining the duration of treatment or stopping the treatment in this isolated subsegmental PE.
So you may have touched on this a little bit already, but once the PE is diagnosed, we know that therapeutic anticoagulation is to be instituted unless contraindicated. And you touched on some of the risk models for bleeding. So maybe if you want to expand on that a little bit and then start to describe to us the options for anticoagulation that are currently available and recommended.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think before we go into it, there's one point that I want to bring it up is that even though I love the ESC classification and I do recommend that everybody should use it, one big thing that it does not include is DVT. Because DVT and PE as a VT, it acts as a spectrum. So if you take an example, and doesn't need scientists to convince you that those things matter most what happens in the leg, because if you have an intermediate high-risk PE and a big clot still left behind in the leg versus if you have intermediate high-risk PE and there's no clot in the leg, you already know that those patients are two different categories of patient, because that is a patient who can potentially still embolize within first 48 hours versus somebody who has completely embolized. So there is a very good evidence and there is a good risk score that we talk about in the paper that DVT with PE is associated with the recurrent disease, associated with adverse outcome at 30-day, up to 30-day mark. So don't ignore the DVT, because what happens in the leg, or the story starts in the leg and then ends in the lung. And if that is a story that is still in the leg than the lung, those are different group of patients. So somehow classification doesn't address that as upfront. Obviously, there's a lot of discussion about it, but I think paying attention to what goes to the leg.
I guess at the time of initial, I'm sorry to interrupt, but the initial diagnosis, everybody gets an ultrasound of the legs to get that baseline.
I think at least in my practice, I would say somebody who is an intermediate risk or higher should get a point of care ultrasound. It doesn't have to be a formal ultrasound. It can be ED, perform point of care 5-point compression ultrasound, because there have been studies that have validated that 5-point compression ultrasound picks up the clinical relevant DVT in the context of PE. So I won't recommend that you have to get a formal ultrasound. Anybody who knows how to do a point of care ultrasound, DVT, quick screening ultrasound, will be able to pick up the significant amount of clot. You may miss a serial clot, but that's not what's going to put you per patient the high risk. That's one. And I think your point about anticoagulation, if you think about PE, should you anticoagulate? And the answer is yes. And I think that applies a lot. I think that's very true when somebody is admitted to the hospital 3-4 days, you know exactly what's going on. And now all of a sudden they have decompensation. You're thinking about PE. Example, somebody got admitted for COPD exacerbation, they were doing fine, and now you have acute concerns for PE, yes, you should anticoagulate while you are waiting for the CAT scan for those patients. When we put ourselves into the ER physicians, right, for them, they have a big differential, because same back pain could be aortic dissection, same back pain could be MI, same back pain could be PE. So I think for ER, it's a little harder, And when we luckily we are on the other side where CT has happened and they're called us. So yeah, I think it's very nice to say that you should anticoagulate everyone unless contraindicated otherwise. But I think from ER perspective, I think that could be practically a little challenging. But I think I find it much more useful inpatient setting, day three, day four, where you have figured out your patient and now there is an acute event happen, because inpatient CATs can take up to 4, 5, 6 hours or even a day. So if you're thinking about PE and there are no contraindication, start an anticoagulation. I think next question is what choice of anticoagulation, right? I think we all used to do a lot of heparin drips and all that stuff. And I think that culture has to change. Has it changed at Temple over the last 2-3 years? Yes, absolutely. And we have gone from unfractionated heparin to the Lovenox or injectable form of heparin. And the reason being that we looked at our own data and there was a paper published in Chest coming out, a large tertiary care center, where we looked at it. Once you start unfractionated heparin or VTE, how many patients are therapeutically anticoagulated at 24 hours? And believe it or not, that number is only 50%. And that we are talking at a tertiary care center. And we also know that those patients who are not anticoagulated at 24 hours, they have an adverse outcome. They have increased mortality, readmission, recurrent disease at 30 days. So this is something that all of us can do that. So changing your practice, keep limiting your unfractionated heparin to a selected patients, high bleeding risk patient, you are considering to give TPA, you're maybe considering them to send them to surgery or some other issues that heparin is justifiable. But apart from that, all of them should be put into the Lovenox form of low molecular weight heparin so that you can get them therapeutically directly, right? Because we can talk about these advanced therapeutic options, but sometimes we lose the focus of anticoagulating your patient is the most important thing, because we know that the clot endothelialization takes 48 hours. So if you have a clot in DVT, that clot can mobilize. So sooner you anticoagulate the patient, faster that clot can endothelialize, less chances of disembolization and further deterioration. So I would change my practice. I would change the practice to Lovenox, and I would suggest for all of us to kind of consider that.
And you anticipated my next question, which we talk about the therapy of the massive and submassive PE. It may entail other specific interventions besides the Lovenox you mentioned. IVC filters, catheter-based treatment, even surgical embolectomy. And the logistics of deciding on this often require a rapid decision and can really make a difference in the overall outcome of the patients. This has led to the concept of the Multidisciplinary Pulmonary Embolism Response Team, or PERT, that I mentioned earlier. And I'd like you to touch on these additional interventions and speak to the PERT consortium of which you are a part.
Yeah, so I think this is where the field has evolved. I think I'll summarize what are our treatment options. So as you mentioned, the IVC filter. Then second, we are talking about catheter-based treatment. Catheter-based treatment also have two sub-buckets of treatment, catheter-directed thrombolysis, where you place an indwelling catheter right and the left and you give the TPA through that. And then you're talking about catheter-based embolectomy, where you're percutaneously accessing the pulmonary arteries and suctioning out the clot. So even the catheter-based treatment has two sub-options. Surgical embolectomy is a traditional surgical approach, going to a surgeon and removing the clot. And finally, I would add on is an ECMO as a supportive therapy, as a bridge therapy, or sometimes it could be a bridge to a destination therapy, is also an option, not at every center, but I think time and again, ECMO also has a good literature supporting the RV. So I think those options are. I think they are fantastic to talk about in a talk like this, but when you talk about executing them in real time, it needs time, it needs effort, it needs coordination. And it may require some certain hard discussions, which patient is appropriate candidate for those. So I think the sooner you start, the better you will justify your patient. And I think you put your patient into the central process of that. And I think that is how the pulmonary embolism response team evolved at the time where the multiple treatment options of PE, which become available, which is now 8-9 years into it. So we certainly at Temple joined a PERT consortium because it was like-minded people from multiple disciplines. And now the PERT consortium has grown as close to more than 150 members nationally. And even the last iteration of ESC guidelines do recommend that the patients who are in intermediate risk or intermediate high risk or massive PE, they recommend the PERT-based discussion to come up with the best treatment plans. Because as the literature is evolving on those catheter-based treatment, I think we still need to individualize the treatment. So I think it has made to the guidelines. I think definition of PERT has become standard. composition of PERT should be local, right? My composition of my PERT team should be slightly different from a community hospital or somebody who has a low volume centers. But I think the concept can be bought out at any institution, because I think together we talk about, we bring different treatment options to the table, we do a better justice to our patient. So yes, I think PERTs are growing, and it's an exciting time for all of us at this in 2023.
Right. Now, following the successful therapy for acute pulmonary embolism, what does the long-term outlook for these patients tend to be? The terms chronic thromboembolic disease and post-PE syndrome are being used, in addition to the more specific diagnosis of CTEP, or chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension. Can you touch on the meaning of these terms and important clinical implications they carry?
Absolutely. So I think because the literature has evolved, and I think because of increased awareness, I think what we also noticed that patients who are presenting as an acute PE, 10% of them, at least in our database and other larger database, we realized 10% of the patients who are presenting with acute PE, they also simultaneously have a component of acute or chronic PE, or a chronic PE itself that gets mistreated as an acute PE. So I think that is a first group that there's an opportunity for education about identifying what are the markers or how the CAT scans look slightly differently for the patients who have chronic clots versus an acute clot. So I think that is a first opportunity improvement there. I think, as you mentioned, the chronic thromboembolic pulmonary hypertension, which is a group 4 pulmonary hypertension in the types of PH definition, it is around 4 to 6%, right? We all like to believe that it is underdiagnosed, but I think it's around 4 to 6%. I think next 10 years, maybe the numbers may change. Now we have a lot of patients with acute PE who are now systemically followed up, because I think in the past, and we even struggle at Temple, that not every acute PE patients get follow up in a timely manner. But I think with PERT, we are doing that better. I think that's the next focus, that the care should not end as an inpatient, but it should continue longitudinally. So I think we'll identify those patients prospectively more. But the CTEP is the end process from an acute PE. It's a long journey, and we only know how that journey ends with CTEP. And that is well defined, that on a right heart cath, you have pulmonary hypertension, you meet the criteria for pulmonary hypertension, you have a classic CTPA BQ scan features of chronic thromboembolic disease. And I think the next step for that, either you go for surgical treatment at expert centers, you go for the medical treatment if you are not a surgical treatment, and treat them with balloon pulmonary angioplasty, which is dilating the chronic occluded pulmonary vessels. So I think that is well defined. I think that has been well defined for many years. I think what we have realized is that 90% of the patients from acute PE before they develop CTEP is something which is not defined. And I think those are the terminologies that you're asking me to comment about. And that field is evolving. Actually, every group has different terminologies. But to give you a perspective on what CTED means, basically it means that patients who have been treated with appropriate anticoagulation, on follow-up imaging, they have the signs of residual chronic clots, meaning that they have signs of webs or bends or some perfusion defects on their VQ scan, but they have not developed a pulmonary hypertension. That is a group that we call a CTED, meaning that you have chronic thromboembolic disease. A very similar radiological term that we use it for that is called RPVO, which is a residual pulmonary vascular obstruction. So a lot of time we get confused between those two terms. And one, RPVO is an old nuclear medicine term. CTED is a more clinical term, but both of them are telling the same story, that some of the clots do not resolve. How to treat them, it really depends on how your patient is doing. What are the other things? And I think one of the common things I would tell our audience is that when you have a CTED, or when you have a patient with RPVO, before you jump to the CTED, because if you have a chronic clots and you have a normal looking echocardiogram, that patient less likely has a CTED, right? Maybe a subcomponent of that may need an invasive right heart cath, a provocative, to prove that they're CTED or not. But I think that's a patient that you want to take and optimize the other causes of dyspnea. What we have realized in our paper, in our data set, and we have published that also, that 15% of them will have undiagnosed sleep apnea. Many of them will have undiagnosed COPD. PE, acute PE, is just an opportunity for us to bring those patients into our outpatient clinic and optimize other disease states. So a lot of, at least in our experience, we have patients who are CTED, where there are small clots left behind, but they don't have pulmonary hypertension, but they have a lot of other causes, obesity, OSA, lung nodules, lung cancers, COPD, diastolic heart failure, those disease states probably we focus on optimizing that. And once you optimize those states and they are still short of breath, that may be the patient where we subject them to a provocative testing to see whether that CTED corresponds invasive hemodynamic with CTEF or not. So that's CTED. And I think post-PE syndrome is something very benign, meaning that you may have no clots left behind. You have radiologically cleared up. You have worked up all other etiology of, you have ruled out all other etiologies, but your patient is short of breath. And that is some of them is post-PE syndrome. Some of them could be anxiety. Some of them could be post-traumatic stress disorder from acute event, because those are very scary life-threatening events. So they fall into that similar bucket, but they kind of move back. So you always look for CTEF, then CTED with comorbidities, looking for your explanation. And then if everything else is ruled out and you have a patient with short of breath, either functional impairment, debility, or just a stress disorder, we put them under the category of post-PE syndrome. I would say that I think hopefully we get to talk again in the next 5 years, because that field is evolving so rapidly that there's a lot of data coming out. So I think this sub-phenotype that we have an overlapping term hopefully will be well-defined in next few years. But I think this is just shows that how underrepresented this disease was in a post-acute phase. And I think thanks to the PERT, thanks to these advanced interventions, this entire disease state is coming to a limelight. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to add one other question. You mentioned the follow-up with these patients. Can you give just some brief guideline as to how you decide about stopping anticoagulation in patients once they're discharged and what your follow-up routine is for them, depending on their clinical course?
Absolutely. So I think every patient that they're with intermediate risk and above PE, we like to follow them into our pulmonary clinic. So like at least on top of their primary care physicians. We never bypass the primary care physician because they should still be the primary source of communication. But those are the patients we definitely would like to bring in the clinic. I like to bring them once before 3 month visit, so that way we can identify the, what anticoagulation they are on. Are they on appropriate dose of anticoagulation? Am I jumping on doing the hypercoagulable workup, which is kind of now favoring out of hypercoagulable workup is not that you want to do it in every patient, because a lot of hypercoagulable workup identifiers only puts you at the risk of first clot, not necessarily the recurrent clots. But again, if you have a young patient, female antiphospholipid antibody syndrome, where DOAC may not be a good choice, I think those are the subgroups that you definitely want to screen them early and identify any side effects. So that's kind of, and if you have an IVC filter, can you remove that IVC filter? That's like four or five things that I try to address in first visit before 3 months. If patient has signs of RV dysfunction after 3 months of full anticoagulation, I would repeat some form of echocardiogram, or we would offer along with that, we will maybe repeat a VQ scan, particularly if they had some form of intervention done to see the progression where they are in their CTED category. So 3 to 6 months, we would repeat the imaging with an echocardiogram. And at 6 months mark, I think, say example, if patient is recovering well, functionally recovering well, markers have improved, those patients, that's the time to see what the regular screening, this cancer screening, you need to do, like look for the age-appropriate cancer screening. And then based on that, between 6 to 9 months, we take a decision. If I think that we haven't identified what could have led to the blood clot, then I would definitely stop the anticoagulation. If not, I would put them on the low-dose prophylaxis anticoagulation, which is for apixaban is 2.5 BID, for Xarelto it is 10 milligram daily. More and more, I think also in the similar field, I think there is a lot of onus being forced upon is that how severe the first clot event was and are you ready to take the chance and what are the bleeding risk scores. So I think even in that category, it comes back to a more of an informed decision with the patient saying that, hey, you have this settled clot, you are near-death experience, you're tolerating anticoagulation, okay. We treated the clot. Now we are doing something to prevent your clot. And this is your bleeding risk, meaning your bleeding risk is as good as my bleeding risk. Would you like to be on anticoagulation? And a lot of those came from an evidence, and then we keep them on at least up to 2 years. So, and then the guideline recommendations are that every year you change and look at their bleeding risk status, right? Particularly somebody is old, now is 75, and now 2-3 years down the road, they have hip and knee issues and they have a fall risk, and that may change how you do that.
Right.
So I think that's where the spectrum is. Also, I would like to mention that once and then that data comes from when you stop the anticoagulation, and if you're not sure what could have led to the first clot, the chance of recurrence after stopping anticoagulation is up to 10 to 15% in the next 2 years. Versus if you have a low dose prophylactic anticoagulation, that drops down to less than 3%. It's as good as it can get. So I think there's a lot of benefit in continuing a low dose anticoagulation, a lot of this unidentified non-pinpoint clot where it came from situations. So that's what we tend to do a lot.
Right. So you've covered a complex condition very comprehensively over the last half hour or so. Would you like to comment on where you see things going in the field, going further, whether there's new diagnostic or new therapeutic modalities?
Yeah, absolutely. I would comment on the diagnostic and treatment, both modalities. I think one of the cool things is happening in the space is that we have the AI softwares who can not only diagnose the PE, but also can restrify based on the RV to LV ratio. So there are three commercially available softwares where you can directly, as soon as somebody has a CAT scan done on the table, you get an instant notification before patient comes off the table. Think about it, what happens right now. Somebody orders a CAT scan, happens after a few hours, and by the time that it gets ready, it's another few hours, and by the time the report gets back to the ER, change of shift happens. So all of this is completely out, because as soon as patient comes off the table, you get a text notification. You can review the images. You can review the RV-12V ratio right hand there. You can activate your PERT team. You can communicate with your PERT team. So all this upfront 6-8 hours that we lose in diagnostic and prognostication has get nullified. So I think that's where the field is evolving. And that's absolutely fascinating. We are lucky at Temple that we have that technology that we are using. I think that is spreading out very fast. And it's not only for PE. The same applications will diagnose your MI and your aortic dissection. So I think going back to your question, can you anticoagulate them faster? Absolutely you can. Because now you're a ER physician who gets a notification saying you have a clot. You're going to put anticoagulation. By the time patient comes, heparin or sublingual oxygen is ready to go in. So I think it has a diagnostic, therapeutic, and risk stratification too. I think where the field is evolving, I think this entire spectrum of this catheter-based treatment, we are into the phase of, we have not only one, two, but at least four randomized controlled trials comparing the different advanced treatment options, meaning comparing catheter-directed lysis with catheter-directed thrombectomy, a trial called PLS trial. There is a high-pytho trial which is comparing catheter-directed lysis to anticoagulation only, because there is a group of believers that catheter-directed therapies don't help the patient. So there is an RCT happening for that. There is also RCT happening for some half-dose TPA enthusiastic in Europe and Northern Canada, PyTHO 3, looking at half-dose TPA versus anticoagulation and see in the intermediate-risk PE. So I think there are a lot of RCTs happening. So I think we'll not only have opinion-based statements, but I think we'll have an evidence-based statements in next few years for that which treatment should be offered and which not. And finally, I think as we briefly talked about, that whole world of post-PE is changing. I hope that guidelines recognize that. So I think I expect that, and I'm not liberated to say much, but I expect that there would be much more post-PE specific guidelines will come out from societies, because acute PE is one separate thing and post-PE phenotypes itself needs its own guidelines. So I hope that some of the societal guidelines will start coming out on post-PE management, which is currently more of a consensus-based opinion statement. So I think those are the things happening in the next 5 years.
Well, maybe we'll be talking to you again in a few years.
Absolutely.
This will be an exciting, changing field. So thanks again to Dr. Rowley for joining us today. Pulmonary embolism is a less frequent topic on LungCast, but in our library, you may enjoy other past conversations on COVID-19, double lung transplant with Dr. Ankit Bharat, or review of lung transplant practices with the Cleveland Clinic team. If you enjoyed today's discussion, be sure again to subscribe and rate LungCast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org or hcplive.com for more news and resources. Until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. Thank you.